Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word. Deuteronomy 1, verse 24. And they departed and went up into the mountains and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. So these are the 12 men from the 12 tribes, the spies, sent in to check out the land 40 years earlier. They had gone in. And this valley of Eshcol is so named for the cluster of grapes that they found and they brought out because the grapes were huge. And that's near Hebron. It's in the south of Israel, about 20 miles south of Jerusalem. And this name, Eshcol, may be preserved to this very day. Just north of Hebron, about 2 miles, there is the head of a river and an area that's abounding in vineyards, and it probably retains the root of this name to this day. Verse 25, they also took some of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down to us, and they brought back word to us, saying, it is a good land which the Lord our God is giving to us. Nevertheless, you would not go up, but you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. So there was trouble. There was trouble afoot. Now, what's worse than having evil done to you? What's worse than that? Doing evil to others. That's worse. And after God's great demonstration of power, destroying Pharaoh and his mighty Egypt, right? God destroys Egypt. These Israelites, 10 of the 12, would dare to doubt God's power to give them victory over Canaan. For of the 12, Moses here just recounts the good word from Joshua and Caleb, but 10 of them said, we can't do it. They're too big and too strong. God had just parted the Red Sea and drowned Pharaoh's army. But he couldn't destroy Jericho and defeat the Anakim? What a shame, that lack of faith. Now, if a similar group of people, that's what the Jews did, right? God delivered them all these miracles, and they go to the next challenge, and they cower away in fear. No, we can't do it. Well, what if there was a different group of people, and they were up against overwhelming odds, and by some fluke of history, they had the victory? Right? Maybe there was a storm and wiped out their enemy. And they'd say, hey, it's our God, Molech. And then they go to the next challenge and they'd say, let's go, we're going to win again. And they'd rush in and get slaughtered. Now, why would the wicked group have confidence in their God, but the group that was delivered by the true God so quickly lose faith? It's amazing that that happens. Men in the Bible, they will trust in fraudulent miracle workers, but they hate those who truly work God's wonders. Why is that? Well, men have antennae on their heads. Every man has an antenna on his head, and you can't see it with natural eyes. You need spiritual eyes. Then you can see their antenna. And they can smell God a mile away. And if he is in a work, then they reject it. But if a wicked man performs an identical work, then they love it. Then it's great. Just like a politician who will follow public opinion if it leads to immorality, pretty regularly. Well, the voice of the people. But on the other hand, if the people happen because of self-interest, happen to support what's righteous, then the politician will be a leader and he'll go it alone and show his true leadership. So people have a natural inclination away from God and righteousness. So the nation wouldn't enter the promised land, but they rebelled against God. Verse 27, and you complained in your tents and said,
Because the Lord hates us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites, to destroy us. What fools, what slaves to their antenna of death, that is, to their allegiance to sin. God hates us, and he did this to destroy us? Man. Verse 28, where can we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our hearts, saying, the people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. Moreover, we have seen the sons of Anakim there. Now, the Anakim, we've talked about these guys in our Genesis Bible study on the flood. There were giants in the earth, both before the flood and afterward. They were enemies of God. They sought to disrupt the messianic bloodline that led to Christ. The first instance of their infestation was wiped out in the deluge, in the flood. They were destroyed. The second instance came afterward, and they were localized in Canaan, the sons of a man named Anak. They were the Anakim. And again, they wanted to disrupt the messianic bloodline. And then they knew that God promised that the Messiah would come through from the land of Canaan. So they focused on that strategy. But King David fought against them and slew the last of their number. So he wiped them forever from the face of the earth. And back in our flood study, we talked about them in some detail. Before the flood, they were the Nephilim. And in Israel's later history, they were the Anakim. Verse 29. Then I said to you, do not be terrified or afraid of them. The Lord your God who goes before you, he will fight for you according to all he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. And in the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you as a man carries his son in all the way that you went until you came to this place. So it had been quite a few months, about a year, since they had left Egypt. And so they had seen God's deliverance from Pharaoh's army, but also his ongoing providence in the wilderness, how the Lord cared for them in that year. Verse 32, yet for all that, you did not believe the Lord your God. What a great title for a witnessing flyer. Yet for all that. Dot, dot, dot. That'd be a good title. Becky, you want to write that one? Yet for all that. And we can end it with Deuteronomy 1:32. Yet for all that, you did not believe the Lord your God. But then that would be a negative ending, right? And today everything has to have a happy ending. And we wouldn't want to scare anyone away. I love that line. Isn't that a great line? Scare them away. Where are you going to scare them to? Hell number two? They're already going to hell number one. Don't worry about scaring them away. Verse 33. Who went in the way before you to search out a place for you to pitch your tents. So God went before them. He found them their campgrounds. You go camping. Well, if you're in an RV, you got to find a nice RV lot. But if you go camping, you want to find a nice place for your tent. You know, that's so important, as we know every year when we climb a mountain. Well, imagine you need tents for 2 million people. It's really important picking out where you're going to camp. And God went before them, and he searched out a place for them to pitch their tents, to show you the way you should go, in the fire by night, in the cloud by day. For God appeared before the nation, the entire nation, leading them by a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. Has anyone ever heard of that group called POF, Pillar of Fire? They have a Christian radio station in town, KPOF. And it's a charismatic Christian group, a neat Christian group, and Pillar of Fire. That's where they get their name from. And God appeared by night as a pillar of fire. It wasn't that the pillar of fire was God, that God was fire, but God manifested himself just like he appeared to Abraham in the fire and the smoke. He appears as a pillar of fire at night in a cloud by day, and they followed. When the cloud moved, they picked up camp and they went after it. And when it stopped, they pitched their tents and they would rest for the night, for the week, or even for many months. Yet with all that supernatural proof of God's existence and of his support, yet for all that, they still grumbled against him and refused to trust the Lord. 34, and the Lord heard the sound of your words and was angry and took an oath. Now, I guess the Calvinists must be right when they say God has no emotions, right? God has no passion, no feeling. God can never be angry. It says, and the Lord heard the sounds of your words and was angry. Oh, that's just a figure of speech. Well, what does it mean? Well, it sure doesn't mean he was angry. Well, then what does it mean? It doesn't mean any. What does it mean when he said he's promised to give them the land? Well, it doesn't mean that. Well, pretty soon, almost everything means nothing. There's a few things. Only the deepest spiritual truths mean anything. And when you get to that point, when the bulk of the story is meaningless, then that's an indication you're off track. Verse 35. So this is what God said. Surely not one of these men of this evil generation shall see that good land of which I swore to give to your fathers. Sounds like he's angry to me. Except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, he shall see it, and to him and his children I am giving the land on which he walked, because he wholly followed the Lord. Now Caleb had been 40 years old when he went in to spy out the land, and now he was 80, still a lot younger than Moses, who was 120. But Moses remembered that 40 years earlier, really 39, 40 years earlier, God had said, I'm going to give that land to Caleb. And then some years later, after Moses had died, Joshua took them into the promised land. They began conquering it. Then Caleb went to Joshua and said, hey, Joshua, remember that land that God said he'd give me? I'm tired. I'd like to get it now. And Joshua said, it's yours. And he got the city of Hebron and that valley of Eshcol with the vineyards. Verse 37, the Lord was also angry with me, that is with Moses, for your sakes, saying, even you shall not go in there. Now, God's primary reason for not letting Moses go into the promised land, even though it's not explicitly stated in the text, his primary reason that he didn't want Moses nor that generation to enter into the promised land was to illustrate something. For every future generation and for all eternity, God wanted to illustrate that the law brings about death. The law does not bring about salvation, but the law brings death. So Moses, the lawgiver, would die rather than enter the promised land. And the day Moses gave the law, 3,000 men were killed. Contrasted to Pentecost, the day that God gave the Spirit, when 3,000 souls were saved. And the entire generation that received the law died in the wilderness in unbelief. Why? Because righteousness does not come by the law. It's not that God wanted them to rebel. No, that's not it. But seeing that they did rebel, how convenient. Let me teach a lesson. He'd rather there have been 12 Calebs and Joshuas on that reconnaissance team. Wouldn't that be great? If they all trusted in God, the Lord would have loved that. But sadly, the majority were evil. What a surprise. 12 on the committee, 2 want to do the right thing. Pretty typical. So because they were evil, God was able to write this story as a great admonition to us, not to return to the burden of the law. Since the law is a burden and it leads to death, not to the promised land, therefore you live by grace. Don't go back under the law, which kills. That's the message. of the story for us in the body of Christ. Yet for all that history and the entire scripture and all the pain, millions of Christians still seek to keep the law. And they hope that striving to obey the Ten Commandments will produce holiness in them. But it never will. So not only Caleb, but verse 38, Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall go in there. Encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. And now we come to a very important verse, but overlooked, I think. The main teaching of this verse is that the law leads to death, not to salvation. But verse 39 is also one of only a couple verses in the Bible that is used to attempt to come up with an age, a particular age for the age of accountability. People say, well, at what age do you reach the age of accountability, when you could go to either heaven or hell based on your own decisions? People say, what age is that? Say, well, age of accountability is not mentioned in the Bible. Well, not by that term, but it's described in this verse and talked about in Romans 5 through 7. We could learn about an age of accountability. Well, let's read the verse and then we'll talk through all this. Moreover, your little ones and your children, who you say will be victims, who today have no knowledge of good and evil, they shall go in there. They shall go in there. To them I will give it, and they shall possess it. So, your children who don't have the knowledge of good and evil, they will enter the promised land. The adults were responsible for the decision not to enter Canaan. And so, on the adults, collectively, came the judgment of death in the desert, on the adults. But to their children, to the infants, the adolescents, to the juveniles, God did not impose that punishment. For that decision came from the adults, not from them. What's more, the adults blamed God and said, God's going to destroy our children. God and Moses. Moses, why did you bring us out of Egypt? God brought us out here to die in the wilderness. And how about our children? What, are they going to be a sacrifice in the desert to God? Is that why he brought us out here? So their blood could be spilled? What a wicked generation. Forget being thankful. What a mess. That was their sentiment. And verse 39 is God's response. He says, oh, you say your little ones will be victims? Let me tell you, they're the only ones who are going to enter into the promised land. Now, how does the Lord describe those young ones? He describes them as your children who today have no knowledge of good and evil. Now, that phrase, the knowledge of good and evil, is a synonym for the law. That's what the law is. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is a symbol of the law. That's what that tree was. Adam and Eve could live in the innocence and righteousness that they inherently had, but if they partook of the law of the knowledge of good and evil, if they partook of this law, then they'd have to live by this law, and they'd have to only do the things the law says, strive to do them, and then they could be approved of. Well, that doesn't work. It's better to be righteous because you are righteous. For us, we could either try to keep the law or let God live in us and let his righteousness flow from us. Those are our two choices. Much of Christianity says we have to keep the law to be righteous. That's tragic. It's a tragic misunderstanding of the entire Bible. Well, at any rate, these little ones, your children, we can see these are they who are under the age of accountability. Your children who do not have the knowledge of good and evil. Okay, they're not old enough. They don't understand right and wrong yet. Now, I really hate to try to explain this verse because I was tempted just to gloss over it. Because this verse is used, if you partly understand this verse, it can lead to error. And it's the error that J. Vernon McGee makes when he talks about the age of accountability. and suggesting that it's very old, perhaps 20 years of age for the average person. Okay, so let's talk through this subject a little bit, and we've debated it in our church. I do not believe for a moment that the age of accountability is 20 years old. We'll go through and talk about why. But before we do, think about the consequence if that were true. Then the Columbine murderers, Harris and Klebold, they would not have gone straight to hell because they died under the age of accountability. So they get to go to heaven and decide whether to stay there or not. Some of the 19 terrorists who died on September 11th would not have gone straight to hell because they were under the age of accountability. Further, I have my own life as evidence to me beyond any doubt that I was extremely aware of right and wrong long before age 20, of good and evil, of God and his enemies at a young age. I didn't come to Christ when I was first convicted of my sin, but a long time afterward, getting saved in 1973 when I was 14. We had a church member speak up this last Sunday school, and he said that he came to know Jesus Christ at age 11, and he remembers very clearly what it meant to him and how important it was to get saved. I've spoken to others who have a certain testimony of being saved much earlier than that. In Romans, the Apostle Paul teaches that he was born alive to God, but then when the commandment came, when he grew old enough to know right from wrong, when he understood the law of God and he willingly broke it, then he died. So he said, I was born alive to God, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. So in my observation, that happens a whole lot earlier than 20 years of age for the average person. Now, a handicapped baby who never matures mentally but lives for 60 years and never grows up mentally, he may never reach the age of accountability. On the other hand, some children may reach it extra young if they're especially aware, especially alert, and their parents teach them right from wrong, and they learn it, they'd be accountable earlier. Remember that God teaches us in the Bible in various places, especially in Romans and in Psalms, that he preaches his message through the creation itself. And through the creation itself, people can realize that there is an eternal, all-powerful, personal God. Just through the creation. And if those people call out to that God, that he will save them. But the vast majority of people don't do that, who worship the creature rather than the creator. They worship creation rather than the God who made it. So what is it exactly that a young child would have to believe in order, a child who's just reached the age of accountability, in order to avoid hell? Well, I don't know exactly, and it's not my responsibility to know exactly, because there's a judge of all the earth, and he will do rightly. We know that. So we have comfort in that. As for my kids, when they profess faith in Christ at a young age, I celebrate. Sometimes you think, yeah, he really meant it. Other times you think, well, this one, he's just saying something to make you happy. And even the ones you think really meant it, you continue to help them to grow and mature in their knowledge of God so that you could be secure in your confidence that your child is really saved. All right. Now, let's get back to the verse. Let me tell you how this verse is used to suggest 20 years of age as the age of accountability. How old were these children, the young ones, who would enter into the land, who would not die in the wilderness? How old were they? Well, Art? Five? All right. Yeah, that's what you might think. I have bad news for you and for me. They were up to 20 years of age. That's how old they were. We know that. We absolutely know that. We can see that over and over and over. Numbers 14:29 says, "The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in this wilderness, all of you from 20 years old and above." And we see that repeatedly in the book of Numbers, from 20 years old and above, all of you who are able to go to war in Israel, 20 years old was the cutoff point. Below that, you couldn't go to war. After that, you could. Well, we find out in the book of Joshua that it says, all the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war had died in the wilderness. You see? So not only does it say it directly, it says it indirectly in a number of other verses too. You find out that everybody who died in the wilderness was 20 years old and older. So everybody up to 20 lived to enter into the promised land. So that's where J. Vernon McGee and others can get an argument that the age of accountability is 20. Now, I utterly reject that conclusion. I disagree with that. But how could you disagree with it when this verse says it? Well, let's talk through that. The point of this verse 39 is not the age of accountability. The point, and it is the main point, once you understand the overview of the whole Bible, the point is that death came to those who were under the law. That's the point. Those who were not under the law enter the promised land. Those under the law get death. Now, that's the general point. Those apart from the law, those who did not have the knowledge of good and evil, life came to them and they entered the promised land. That's not only the point of the verse, but of the whole story of the giving of the law, of the dying in the wilderness, that deliverance does not come from the law, but it comes to the uncircumcised, to those who entered in for the most part. They were all uncircumcised. Well, were they all uncircumcised? Well, not really, because all those kids who were over a year old, they had all been circumcised in Egypt before they left. So a good percentage of them that went in were still circumcised. But when you read Joshua, you sort of get the impression they were all uncircumcised, and he had to circumcise the whole country. Now, that's a symbol of if you're under law or under grace. Circumcision is under law. Uncircumcision is under grace. So all those who were circumcised died in the wilderness, but not really. The younger ones didn't. From 19 down to 1 year of age, they were circumcised. They didn't die. So Moses, God, is taking a story and he's speaking in general terms in order to make a spiritual point. And when you speak in general terms, quite often there's any number of particulars that don't fit in exactly. But you're not trying to cover everyone. You're speaking in general terms.
Hey, this is Bob Benyard. If you would like to hear more, you could go to our store online. Go to kgov.com, click on the store, and then you could get our Bible studies, or go to the subscriptions where you could subscribe to our sermons and our Bible studies. You could get really fun verse-by-verse studies or topical Bible studies. I think you'll love it.